This is Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. What does a 2,000-year-old epic have to say about refugees, love, empire, disinformation, duty, and what it costs to live with integrity? A lot, as it turns out. Today, we revisit Virgil's Aeneid, one of the most enduring epics ever written. I speak with classic scholars Scott McGill and Susanna Wright, whose powerful new translation brings the poem's emotional depth, political complexity, and timeless humanity vividly to life for today's readers. We talk about epic storytelling, migration and imperialism, duty and desire, and why this ancient poem still speaks so urgently to our world. Then we look back at some of our most notable episodes of 2025. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Virgil's Aeneid is one of those great works of literature that I never seem to find the time to read, much like its sister classics, the Iliad and the Odyssey. It's been about 2,000 years since Virgil wrote the Aeneid at the behest of the Roman Emperor Augustus. It tells a story of what happened after the fall of Troy, when the Trojans became first refugees, then conquerors of Italian tribes, near what would become, three centuries later, the city of Rome. Virgil's Aeneid is a tale of thrilling adventure, adversity, doomed romance, fateful battles, and profound loss. Through its stirring account of human struggle, meddling gods, and conflicting destinies, the poem brings to life the triumphs and trials that led to one of the most powerful societies the world has ever known. The Aeneid was composed by a singular poetic genius, and it has ever since been celebrated as one of the greatest literary achievements of antiquity. Scott McGill and Susanna Wright's new English translation of the Aeneid captures both the grandeur of the epic and its deeply human emotional core. In the following conversation, they talk about collaboration, translation craft, and why the Aeneid remains one of the most morally and politically provocative works ever written. They also explore unforgettable characters like Aeneas and Dido, the role of the goddess Rumor as perhaps the first purveyor of fake news in literature, and what we gain when we keep engaging with the classics today. Let's listen now. Scott McGill and Susanna Wright, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. We're so happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So I confess I had not read the Aeneid before this, nor the Iliad, nor the Odyssey. I feel a little embarrassed about that, but I don't think I'm in an unusual place. And so we'll get into just how thrilling a story this is, actually. It is amazing. I was watching the scenes go before my eyes mentally as I was reading this. So it outdid my expectations. There have been so many English versions of the Aeneid over the years. What made you want to take on a new translation, and what made it stand out or be different from the others? And Scott, maybe start there.
Yeah, so this project began in 2018. Susanna, at that point, was an undergraduate at Rice University, where I teach. And as part of her senior thesis, she was translating sections of Aeneid Book Two. So it's a product of a personal relationship, certainly, that she and I have, and that she and I have to Virgil and to translation. We have a kind of enthusiastic partnership as translators for roughly the last decade or so. We chose to translate the Aeneid. I think a couple of things that we wanted to kind of do with our translation. One is to really tap into the humanity of the poem, the deep pathos that Virgil generates, the power of the emotional world of the poem. We were really keen to try to capture that. We were also interested very much in tonally how to do that, how to capture the grandeur of the poem, but make it speak to a contemporary audience in a way that could move them emotionally. So those were two of our primary goals, I would say.
And Susanna, then say a little bit about how this was different, maybe than other approaches to the Aeneid.
So one of the main kind of efforts we were making in the translation was to strike a middle ground between accessibility and elevation. Virgil's poetry was described in antiquity as being neither bombastic nor overly humble. So one of the ways in which we wanted to set ourselves apart from other translations was to try to capture that very specific combination.
Yeah, and I think that that's what made it not only easy to read, but also brought the emotional punch to the page. Now, your collaboration. I loved reading your description of this kind of dialectic between the two of you. You know, this kind of synergy, I think, is even a better term. Susanna, talk a little bit about that first.
So this project very much did grow. I liked the language of dialectic. We very much were in dialogue with one another, kind of at every step of this, and every line of the translation is a product of that dialogue. So when we first started working on the project, we actually were taking kind of something of a divide and conquer method. Essentially, each of us would kind of draft a book and then send it to the other, and we proceeded in that way through actually a draft of all 12 books of the Aeneid. But at a certain point, we realized there was only so much that the track changes features on our word processors could handle, and that in order to kind of take the translation to the next level, we needed to be able to work through kind of every part of it in real time. So starting, I would say, in about the fall of 2022, when I had a research fellowship from my graduate program and was able to be in Houston in person, we really began kind of over again, already having a full rough draft of the entire thing. We began over again at line one of book one, and started just kind of working through every beat together. And in fact, we kind of made our way through the poem in that fashion, not just once, but actually kind of several more times as the revision process unfolded. So it really was a matter of, you know, l learning to read each other's cues, learning to kind of be prepared to let go of ideas that, you know, that we might have thought, oh, in the moment, that seems really clever and that weren't quite the right fit for the line, learning to kind of be receptive to ideas that the other had. All these things, I think, really, on the one hand, m made the project just kind of a joy to work on. It had this sort of this combination of kind of a logic puzzle and a creative, the creative element of trying to find what felt like just the right word and just the right tone for a specific moment. But it also really, I think, any project like this, there are going to be moments when one feels a bit stumped, or like perhaps, you know, perhaps this is kind of the best thing I can come up with. Maybe I'll just leave it there. And having, I think, the voice of a collaborator in many ways helped us to kind of push past those moments. And when we were feeling a bit, you know, a bit stuck, that was always exactly the time it seemed when the other one would have a suggestion that would kind of pull us out of those moments and enable us to maybe see the possibilities a bit differently.
I'll just say too, there's a psychological benefit to working with someone else because, of course, writing is lonely, and writing often leads to moments of despair when you feel that you've hit a wall and you simply can't go any further. And it's helpful to have someone else there who can who A is sympathizing with you, of course, but B is able to kind of pull you out of that by making a suggestion, by keeping things going. So I do think the translation is significantly better because the two of us collaborated than it would have been if either of us did it individually.
And we are talking with Scott McGill and Susanna Wright about their new translation, and what a terrific translation it is, of Virgil's Aeneid. Now, for those of us, and I'm sure we're many, who are just have the foggiest notion of what the story is about, Scott, I wonder if you could just take a stab at giving us a really brief overview of what this is about, and then I'm going to ask Susanna to tell us a little bit about how it came about.
Sure, yes. It's a bit of a challenge to try to summarize a poem of nearly 10,000 lines, but I will try. The Aeneid is about the Trojans, the Trojan people. It begins in the immediate aftermath, the aftermath of the Trojan War, where the Greeks have destroyed the city of Troy, leaving Aeneas and a number of fellow refugees as survivors. They are to make their way to Italy. They discover that Italy is their new fated homeland. The journey to Italy is a difficult one, not least because the goddess Juno is opposed to them and keeps throwing up obstacles in their way. But ultimately, they make their way from Troy, which is in today's Turkey, from this fallen city, with some many stops along the way, including one in Carthage, where they encounter the queen Dido of Carthage. But they do make their way ultimately to Italy. This, as I said, is their fated homeland. However, those who already live there don't necessarily agree that this is the Trojans' fated homeland. This is because Juno stirs them up to oppose the Trojan presence. So once they get to Italy, a war ensues, and the war occupies, for the most part, the second half of the Aeneid. Ultimately, the Trojans emerge victorious, but the poem ends with this notoriously difficult and ambiguous image where Aeneas has defeated his arch enemy Turnus, but the poem ends with Aeneas killing him in a merciless way after Turnus has actually pleaded for mercy. So it's a very violent ending, a very abrupt ending, perhaps an unexpected one because Aeneas is renowned for his piety and one might expect him to exhibit some mercy to Turnus. He does not. He's in the throes of rage and wrath as the poem ends, and then there's a quick, and that's it, right? The poem just cuts out. So it's a really, really interesting ending, a really compelling ending, and a difficult ending to interpret. But ultimately, right, those Trojans who settle in Italy, I'll end with this, those Trojans who settle in Italy, ultimately, roughly 300 years later in mythological time, they will become the Romans because Romulus and Remus, they can trace their line back, according to the Romans, trace their line back to Aeneas and the Trojans.
Now, Virgil died before he could complete that. Could that be why this is so abrupt?
That's a really good question, and I think a lot of interpreters have raised that as a possibility. I myself don't think so, and this is simply because Book 12, the final book of the epic, is already the longest book of the poem. It's nearly 1,000 lines itself. I just don't think Virgil would have been able to create a kind of satisfactory resolution in the amount of space that he would have had, the amount of space that he would have felt that he could add to that final book. So I think he wants it to end in that incredibly abrupt way.
So, Susanna, tell us, how did this book come about? Why, when was it, just a little bit before the after the Common Era? I think it's CE now and then BCE. So it was just a little bit before that, in the time of Julius Caesar and later. How did this come about? Why did he write this poem?
Yes, so Virgil writes the Aeneid in the 20s BCE. So this is the time period when actually Augustus has taken power and is consolidating a new regime in Rome. So Julius Caesar has previously been assassinated in 44 BCE. This kicks off kind of a significant amount of continuing chaos and civil war that ultimately leads to a conflict between Octavian, as he was then known, the future Augustus, and the forces of Mark Antony and Cleopatra. So they face off with one another in a naval battle at Actium off the coast of Greece in 31 BCE. And from that point, when Octavian slash Augustus emerges triumphant, he begins to consolidate power as a future emperor of Rome. So Virgil is writing the Aeneid very much in the wake of Actium. Virgil already, by that point in his career, was known for some other poetic works, the Eclogues and the Georgics. The Aeneid is his just masterful epic poem. One of the longest-lasting questions about it has been to what extent Virgil is writing it in connection with Augustus. We know that he had promised previously in earlier poetic works that he would write a great epic in Augustus's honor, and that Augustus seems to have kind of made it known that is something he would like to receive. But the Aeneid takes a really, really complicated stance toward Augustus as a figure and toward Roman power in general. So we have, on the one hand, a strain in the poem that does celebrate the kind of Roman project and what is, from Aeneas's perspective, the Roman future. But there's also a strain that can be read as kind of questioning or undercutting that celebratory approach. And certainly things like the ending of the poem, where we see Aeneas, who in other ways at times maybe seems to kind of prefigure Augustus, when we see him give in to this, you know, immense wrath and fury in the final moments of the poem, one can wonder, you know, how might Augustus have received this ending and the poem as a whole?
Yeah, that's so interesting, because Augustus at least built himself by reputation that I remember as a pretty enlightened ruler. He wanted to bring order after a long time of political chaos to Rome. And in some ways, Aeneas resonates with that in terms of his faithfulness to his duty, often in contradiction to his actual desires. In other words, he takes his role as a leader seriously and puts it above his own personal needs, often to his own great sorrow. So I wonder, either one of you can take that, if you just want to address the nuances of this character, Aeneas, as it is created in this poem, and were there translation choices you made that enabled that to become sharper?
Sure, maybe I can start, and then Susanna, yes? Aeneas is a fascinating hero. He's a new kind of epic hero, very different from the Homeric epic hero. The Homeric hero is concerned with his own kleos, his own fame, his own reputation, maybe living on in song, living on in memory, through great deeds. But it's a very kind of personal and perhaps even kind of selfish desire for that fame. Aeneas is selfless. He's self-sacrificing. He's fundamentally defined by his commitment to his community, to his responsibilities, to those around him, to his fellow refugees, and even to history. He doesn't know that the Roman people will follow, right? But we as readers do. And there's a sense that his sense of pietas, his sense of duty, his selfless commitment to duty includes setting the conditions so that the Romans can one day appear. So it's a wonderful shift from the Homeric model of what an epic hero is. It's a very Roman model, as you said, because it's defined fundamentally by this notion of pietas, which is a cardinal Roman virtue. It's also a cardinal Roman virtue for Augustus. Augustus was gifted a shield from the Roman Senate in 27 BCE, listing some virtues that he embodied. One of those virtues was pietas. So there is this identification between Augustus and Aeneas, which again, complicates things, especially when you get to the end of the poem.
And pietas meaning duty, devotion, responsibility.
Exactly. Duty, devotion. I mean, it can mean devotion and duty to the gods, right? So in that way, it kind of aligns with the English word piety, but also to one's family, also to one's community if one is in a position of leadership, right? But this kind of public identity and one's commitment to one's different public roles.
And to speak maybe a bit as well to the translation side of that question, pietas as a term was an incredible challenge. It's a notorious difficulty for all translators of the Aeneid, because it does encompass such a broad range of different kinds of duties. As Scott said, everything from, you know, family and the gods to one's followers and fellow refugees and so on. So just leaning on something like the English derivative piety would work well, or pious. Aeneas himself is described with the adjective form of pietas, pius, 20 times in the poem. So it is a characteristic that's very, very closely associated with him. Leaning on piety or pious as translations of this term would do justice to the religious devotion, but wouldn't really address, right, the many other kind of aspects of pietas that relate to human relationships with others and with their obligations. So what the decision that we made ultimately was to use kind of different terms for pietas depending on which obligation was in focus at a particular moment. So there are times when Aeneas's devotion to the gods is in focus and when therefore we use pious. More commonly, things like dutiful, devoted, loyal, and so on, seemed to us to speak more effectively to an English reader of the kinds of obligations that Aeneas feels toward the others in his life, his parents, his child, and so on. So It's a long-standing difficulty for translators of the poem. Pietas is such a tough one that it, in fact, does appear in the Dictionary of Untranslatables as something that's just incredibly challenging to capture in English. But we felt that our first obligation was to our audience and to the kind of immediacy and urgency of the text. And for that reason, using kind of a set of synonyms that could bring those ideas into focus felt most appropriate. And sometimes there, I should say also, sometimes there's a tension. Sometimes Aeneas is described as pious in a moment when we don't necessarily feel that he's behaving that way. And I think that's a really characteristic element of what Virgil is doing in the Aeneid as well. He's not interested in showing us an Aeneas who is just some kind of perfectly self-sacrificing figure. He's interested in showing us how much it actually costs Aeneas, both on a personal level and to a certain extent also what it costs to Aeneas's own humanity to live into these obligations and to kind of repeatedly give this sense of public duty priority over his own private desires and relationships. That's something that I think Virgil really wants us to attend to and wants to make us contemplate. What are the costs of giving so much weight to these obligations that you actually may, in fact, like fail in other kinds of obligations to yourself and others while doing it?
And of course, the prime example of that is his relationship to Dido. Dido, the queen of Carthage, who breaks some of her own, I guess, pietas, because she is a widow and she had determined not to remarry, but she falls in love with Aeneas and he falls in love with her. And she is a vivid character in this story. One of the most emotional parts of this poem is the story of their relationship and of Aeneas is trying to sneak away from her so that he can follow his duty to his destiny rather than his duty to his love. So talk a little bit about that and, you know, what kinds of translation issues did that arise in you? Because it is one of the central pieces or most famous parts of this poem.
Absolutely. I think it's probably the best known material in the entire Aeneid, and it's inspired a lot of different art, Christopher Marlowe's play, Purcell's opera, right? So it's a well-known story and an incredibly dramatic story. And as you said, it really brings to the fore the dilemma that Aeneas faces, the contrast between duty and personal desire, what he wants and what he must do, and how these things can be, in fact, in conflict. It is true that Aeneas does, in some sense, appear maybe to want to kind of skulk away, and perhaps he doesn't handle the situation as well as he could have in justifying himself and explaining to Dido what he must do. We were pretty, I think, sensitive though to the ways in which Virgil, even though Virgil's pretty reticent about how Aeneas feels in Book 4, he does give us glimpses into the fact that this is a self-sacrifice. This is a real moment of self-sacrifice, that he did feel deeply for Dido, but he knows that he has this larger responsibility, and the gods have told him as much. Jupiter sent Mercury to tell him as much. So he knows that he has to give up what he wants for what he must do. But the star of Book 4 is, of course, Dido. Dido is an incredibly compelling, vivid character. From about the second half of the book onward, she dominates the narrative, especially with these really long kind of operatic soliloquies. I think the biggest translation challenge for us there was to kind of convey the drama of that, the pathos of that, the emotion of that, without slipping into melodrama, right? And I feel like, and I think, Susanna, you agree that Dido, that Virgil himself walked that line pretty delicately too. So that was a real challenge for us, right? To make sure that you try to convey the power of Dido's emotion without slipping into melodrama, making it maybe appear even faintly ridiculous. So that was difficult. And we certainly hope that we pulled it off.
I think you did. I mean, it was really a wonderful part of the book. And we are talking with Scott McGill and Susanna Wright about their new translation of Virgil's Aeneid. Now, there's a lot in this poem that resonates with our contemporary period right now. One of them is the goddess Rumor, who is a fascinating figure in this, almost like the first embodiment of fake news. talk about this figure and Virgil's perspective. I think incredibly, you know, it's just it just feels so modern, his perspective on how rumor spreads to create conflict.
Absolutely. Rumor, I think, is one of the central plot devices in the Aeneid and one of the ways in which conflicts often get set up. So we have in book four in particular, there's an amazing detailed description of Rumor as a character, this kind of monstrous goddess with many mouths and eyes and ears to kind of pick up and repeat information of all kinds, kind of delighting in this mingling of fact and fantasy. There's a sort of sinister gleefulness to Rumor as a character. Not only does she distribute false information that causes all kinds of trouble, but she revels in doing it as well. And I think there is much for modern readers to kind of pick up on in this. I love that description of Rumor as sort of the first personification of fake news. She is responsible, among other things, for bringing about things like drama surrounding the end of Aeneas and Dido's love affair. Rumor spreads word of their romance to Iarbas, who was another king in Libya who had been a suitor of Dido's and is very, very upset to learn that Dido has rejected him, but is instead has started this relationship with Aeneas. So the tricky thing about Rumor is that there's often, though, a kernel of truth in what she says. She's not wrong in describing that Aeneas and Dido are having this affair, but there, as elsewhere, she has a way of mingling in bits of information that spin these kernels of truth in ways that make it trickier or more problematic or at least partially false. We also see Rumor doing things like spreading the word of kind of deaths that have occurred on the battlefield, taking part in kind of stirring up emotion in the conflict in Italy once Aeneas and his soldiers and followers arrive there. But I would say that the biggest characteristic of Rumor is her pervasiveness and secondarily the kind of mischief with which she tends to spread this kind of information.
And another also incredibly resonant part of the, not part of this poem, but theme of this poem, really, with our own age, is how much it touches on empire, invasion, migration, colonialization, refugees. So I'd like you to talk about that, just how important that is to the poem and what it can say to us today. But also the surprising way in which Juno, who has played such a pernicious role throughout, actually brings about a kind of reconciliation at the end, shows a way towards peace among enemies that I think is quite interesting. So that's a lot to bite off. Maybe, Scott, if you want to start and Susanna can take it up afterwards.
Sure. So I can start with the question of the status of the Trojans, and they are both refugees and settlers slash imperial conquerors. Especially in the first half of the poem, they're more refugees. Book two recounts the story of the fall of Troy, and at the end of that book, they are referred to as a kind of band of refugees, these survivors of this horrific fall of their city who must find a new home. So one of the things that I think the Aeneid touches on for us is the kind of responsibilities that all people have toward refugees. What responsibilities do other populations have to take them in and to care for them? On the other hand, once the Trojans get to Italy, they look to, again, to the native Italian population, they don't look as much like refugees, and they look more like a foreign presence and foreign conquerors. Again, this is significantly through the doings of Juno, but this is the kind of identity that the Trojans take on there. So we feel that resistance, and I think we feel some sympathy, certainly, with that resistance. It is the case that, of course, the Romans themselves, notoriously, they were an empire, like many, many ancient civilizations. They had no post-colonial impulses, right? They celebrated empire and the spread of empire. But again, what's interesting about Virgil's approach is that he himself doesn't, in a kind of tinny, propagandistic way, celebrate empire. It's true that the Trojans win out in Italy. It's true that they ultimately will be the Romans. The cost of that mission, even in the second half of the poem, is very, very much in evidence. A lot of the sympathy lies with the Italians who are defeated. I think of Mezentius toward the end of Book 10, Camilla toward the end of Book 11, and of course, Turnus at the end of the poem, these great Italian fighters. And Virgil's sympathies at those moments seem to lie more with them than with Aeneas and the Trojans. So again, it's like it's certainly a story. It can be seen as a story of imperial conquest, especially in the second half of the poem, but it's a very, very kind of complicated, ambiguous message that ultimately emerges.
And I'll add, I think the Aeneid has a lot to tell us about these kind of geopolitical cycles by which the Trojans, who are themselves a displaced people, even as they search for this new homeland, they ultimately find their way to a place where others already live. And as a result of that, what they believe is their destiny causes them to displace other people. So Virgil seems to be, in many ways, kind of not very interested in adhering to narrow ideological categories. He instead, I would say, kind of moves us to try to think beyond those and to kind of expand our sympathies and see the ways in which actually the picture can be much more complex than it might appear on the surface. And I think for us as translators, a real priority was making sure that that came through, that those ambiguities and uncertainties were palpable to readers, that we, on the one hand, didn't water down the violence that occurs when the Trojans arrive in Italy, that they bring with them as they become conquerors, but that also in those moments like the end of Book Two, in the first line of the poem, to use the language of displacement, use terms like refugees when they're appropriate. That felt to us like an important way of kind of making those elements feel accessible to modern readers too. And to speak also to that moment that you mentioned in Book 12 with Jupiter and Juno. So in that conversation, right, Juno makes her kind of final agreement to sort of stand down from this kind of vicious rage that has led her to pursue the Trojans and kind of harry them throughout the entire poem so far. And her condition for surrender is that she wants to see the identity of the Trojans more or less completely obliterated. So she agrees to give up her wrath. She agrees to let them kind of win out in Italy. But the kind of winning out to which she agrees is actually one on which the Trojans are kind of forced to submit to terms that look very much as though they had been defeated, that the kind of cultural identity of the Italians will, in fact, subsume the identity of the Trojans over time. This is expressed as a form of survival that really only involves their genetic composition of the future Italian people. So the Trojans will survive only in their mingled flesh, but the name of Troy, all their traditions, their dress, all these things will be totally eclipsed. And I think that's another way in which, for Virgil, like sometimes winning and losing are two sides of the same coin. And the Trojans definitely don't come out looking like unambiguous victors of that conflict. There's a high cost to the Italians, but there's a very high cost culturally to the Trojans as well.
And yet, in many ways, that is what happens when people come from elsewhere and take over other lands. They assimilate. So that's almost a natural process, one can imagine.
I think that's right. I think Juno just wants to kind of accelerate it. The Romans had to deal with the fact that their ancestors were the Trojans, who lost this catastrophic war against the Greeks and who were Eastern. And from the Roman perspective, there was a Roman prejudice that privileged the West over the East. The East for them was Greece, was Egypt, was today's Middle East, including today's Turkey, so Troy. So Virgil had to kind of finesse that too. And one of the ways he does this is by having Juno, right, set these conditions that do ultimately make the Trojans disappear by assimilating them so dramatically to the Italians.
So finally, after spending so much time inside this poem, the two of you, how has translating the Aeneid possibly changed the way you understand its meaning?
I think in lots of ways, the process of creating this translation, most of all, has kind of made me feel all the more deeply just the incredible artistry of Virgil's poetry, and especially the ways in which he brings us very immediately and urgently into conversation with, on the one hand, major themes like how to balance living for yourself and living for others, what obligations we have to future generations, how to keep going when all seems lost, things along these lines. But he also does it with such power and such emotional immediacy. So I think for me, we've thought often as we've moved through this translation about a particular line in Tennyson where he addresses Virgil as "Thou majestic in thy sadness at the doubtful doom of humankind." And I think the kind of majesty of that sadness, but at the same time, just the sheer humanity of it, the fact that we can feel on the one hand the epic elevation, but also the kind of vivid and visceral power of the emotional experiences of these characters. I think kind of as we've lived with the text in the years that we've been translating it, that that's something that has come through to me more and more with every successive round of revision.
I'll just say very, very briefly that I think we've come to know all the characters in the Aeneid that much better. Like any classicist, we've read this poem countless times. But with translating it, it's the form of like close reading you can do, where you're really contemplating virtually every single word. Along the way, you're really trying to capture the characters and the voices of these characters and what they feel and what motivates them and what they endure and just really try to get inside of them. And that includes the gods and the cast of mortals, especially Dido and Aeneas, but really the secondary characters as well. So I do think a kind of greater intimacy with these characters, and in many, many cases, even a greater sympathy with these characters, I think really emerged as well.
And my final question, the classics is one of those fields which has become less and less prominent, in contemporary society. You are classicist. What do you feel we lose when we don't pay attention to them? What is their importance to us?
That's a great question. I mean, I think fundamentally we lose a sense of history, right? And the ways in which history lives on in our contemporary society. I think we also lose some transcendent art. I think the beauty of the Aeneid, but also poets like, well, Homer and the Greek tragedians and Ovid and Horace and, great prose writers too. I think it's such a loss just to our cultural history. I think one of the great misconceptions about classics is that it's somehow conservative and reactionary. And it really is anything but that. Obviously, there are voices of conservatism in antiquity, without question, Augustus being one of them. But as I hope we've conveyed in this conversation today, a poem like the Aeneid, challenges the status quo, challenges dominant cultural assumptions. Like all great art, it raises questions without providing easy ideological answers. And so much of the classics, so many of the classical texts do this. So I do think we also lose that, right? We lose a kind of history of deep and rich engagement with the biggest questions that, again, don't come down on easy ideological stances.
I would add, it's certainly the case with these, great ancient works that we are separated from them where we sit today by great gulfs of space and time, cultural distance. All these things, I think, can, on the one hand, make it challenging at times for kind of readers to find their way in. But if we can just find our way in, I think, on the other hand, that there's immense value in kind of challenging ourselves to reach across those gulfs, to see, how we can find points of connection with people who lived far away from us, deep into the past, and had very different experiences on the day-to-day than what many of us are used to today. I think both practicing that skill as we come to ancient texts and then taking that with us into the world as we encounter people whose experiences and perspectives are very different from our own. I think there's a lot of value in that, rather than just sort of writing something off and saying, oh, well, it's not relatable, or it's very different from what I'm used to, or I just kind of can't get into it. Challenging ourselves actually to find those points of connection and ways of relating. I think many of these ancient works actually can surprise people. There is a lot, and I certainly felt, part of our work on this translation was unfolding, for instance, during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so reading these great scenes of loss and lamentation during that time really was something that spoke to me in new ways. So I think for readers just to approach these texts with an open mind and try to cultivate that skill of reaching for connection across distance is incredibly valuable. And you kind of never know what you're going to find or in what ways it may enrich your life to do so. But I think it's a real loss not to put ourselves to that kind of challenge.
And your wonderful translation, Scott McGill and Susanna Wright, of the Aeneid is just a perfect entryway into that kind of understanding. This has just been such a terrific conversation. I want to thank you so much, both of you, for doing this beautiful translation and for talking with us here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Scott McGill is professor of humanities at Rice University. Susanna Wright is an assistant professor of classical studies and Roman history, also at Rice. Virgil, the Aeneid, comes with an introduction by Emily Wilson and is published by W.W. Norton. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to listen again, like, and subscribe to the podcast. We're putting this show together the last day of 2025, which gives us a chance to reflect and share with you some of the episodes that stood out for us. In February, we spoke with Aaron Robertson about his book, The Black Utopians. It uncovers the rich yet often overlooked history of Black utopian communities in America, places born from struggle but driven by hope and self-determination. From the historic town of Promised Land, Tennessee, to the radical vision of Black Christian nationalism in Detroit, Robertson took us on a journey through forgotten movements that sought to build a better world right here in America.
I had always been really interested in the history of American countercultures, but so much of the conversation about American utopianism seemed to leave out the experiences of Black Americans. I think that, you know, groups like the Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam tended to be the ones that got most of the attention during that period. But there were so many other groups and so many other initiatives throughout the 20th century that I think embodied this sort of anti-authority, anti-capitalist approach to life that I wanted to explore.
In March, we spoke with journalist Amanda Becker about the impact of the Dobbs decision, the legal chaos that followed, and how the fight for abortion rights continues. Becker shared insights from her book, You Must Stand Up, detailing the rollback of reproductive rights, the history of anti-abortion legislation, and the movement's ongoing efforts to restore access through ballot measures, legal strategies, and political action.
You know, the doctor running that clinic that I followed out in Arizona, Gabrielle Goodrick, Dr. Goodrick, she was going, you know, on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, trying to figure out, could she open the clinic? Could she not open the clinic? If she could open the clinic, what type of services could they provide? And they had to get very creative during that period in order to deliver services for their patients. Now, of course, Arizona, just in the November elections, voters protected abortion and overturned even that 15-week ban. So abortion is now legal in Arizona again.
Also in March, award-winning journalist and author Omar El Akkad joined us to discuss his latest book, One Day Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. It's an urgent and unflinching critique of empire, media, and the failures of mainstream liberalism, seen through the lens of Israel's genocide in Gaza and U.S. complicity with it.
I mean, I think one of the things about this book is that obviously I wouldn't have started writing it were it not for the slaughter in Gaza. But, you know, Palestinians can tell their own stories and have been telling their own stories. This for me, is very much a book about my anchoring towards the West, which has been going on for the vast majority of my life. There's a reason I sound the way I do. There's a reason that I am culturally fluent here. And when most people who are born and raised in this part of the world talk to me, I generally don't feel far away. And so in a sense, I think for me, this book is about this notion of the negative space of becoming that kind of person, the things that I chose not to think about. And this is a particularly significant kind of self-indictment because it's not like I was sitting around during those years at a great distance from the things I'm talking about. I was a journalist. I was in Afghanistan. I was in Guantanamo Bay. I was in Ferguson, Missouri, covering the protests there. I saw some of these cracks up close. I think the difference over the last year and a half is that there's a kind of immediacy and intimacy and complicity that, and perhaps this is a function of my own naivete, I hadn't felt before. It's a very jarring thing to witness a genocide being live streamed and have your politicians and elected representatives tell you that this is a good thing and that you're a bad person if you oppose it, and know that you are paying for this. Right? I'm paying for those bombs. I'm killing those kids. That's me. And so I think the immediacy of it, the intimacy of it, and my own complicity in it has forced me to think about the kind of human being I am with relationship to this part of the world in a very different way. And that's essentially what I think this book is about.
AI was featured in several episodes. We spoke with novelist Ray Naylor about Where the Axe is Buried, a gripping novel that imagines a future governed by AI prime ministers and mass surveillance. It's a chilling look at authoritarianism, technocratic solutions, and the erosion of personal freedom, as well as the courage of people to stand up and resist that. You have a character in the novel, Ray Naylor, in Where the Axe is Buried, who says, "Real evil is nothing more than a curious person inventing new monsters because they can, without a thought for the consequences." And it seemed to me that that's an apt description of people like Sam Altman and Elon Musk.
Yeah, I think there's an aspect of competitive capitalism that is deeply irresponsible. And I think one of the most, you know, disturbing things to me is how no one ever seems concerned about the ethical or moral concerns of things that are being not just invented, but then pushed into the market in all kinds of ways. And I think this has been the case with virtually all inventions that have been made. But AI is a particularly dangerous one. One of the reasons it's dangerous is because people are totally befuddled about what it is, right? Another reason it's dangerous is because people are very distracted by this idea of consciousness or sentience. And the questions they're not asking themselves in enough detail are, how is this going to change the marketplace, damage people's work, damage quality of life, affect political decision-making, et cetera, et cetera. And so one of the great dangers for me of artificial intelligence is this name, artificial intelligence, and the way that it has manipulated discourse so that people are not properly paying attention to the concrete impacts that this technology, which is just very sophisticated computer programs, largely using language like math, right, with huge computational power and a really complex series of logic gates and other great ways to make it look as if thinking is happening in many ways. The questions they're not asking themselves are the most dangerous ones. What happens to employment? What happens to job security? What happens to information, right? What happens to our sense of history? What happens when, instead of going to a website, you're asking a question and you're getting an aggregate response from many sources, many of which cannot be verified or are not properly verified.
Sylvia Park told us about her novel, Luminous, a hauntingly prescient look at AI, identity, and the blurred line between human and machine. The robots are, in a very real sense, slaves, but I felt this novel seems to struggle toward a vision of equality between robots and humans. And you've just said that what you foresee is the opposite, but do you think it would be possible to create, you know, is another world possible between humans and robots?
Oh, that's a hard question, because I think the only way equality would be possible is if robots were like us, because we already struggle with equality and equity between fellow humans, right? Because we love to find ways to talk about how different we are, or find ways that the other is not as deserving. We just find ways to discriminate against them. But I think with our struggle for equality with between robots and humans, it's, for me, it actually seems quite impossible, because I don't think robots are going to be like us. I think they might actually turn out to be a completely different creation or a different existence. And therefore, their concept of equality might also be completely different from what we envision. And at the moment in my book, robots are, as you described, treated as second class. They're also treated as property. But what I wanted to portray, especially with the end of Luminous, is to hint at the thing about the singularity is it's a tipping point. Because once we do tip over, then it's a whole new world.
And we spoke with Bruce Halsinger about his novel Culpability. It's a story about a family shattered by a self-driving car accident and about the ethical and emotional consequences of artificial intelligence.
And a lot of people in this world, in the AI ethics space, feel this way. She doesn't want machines to be a kind of moral prosthetic. In other words, she doesn't want us to give machines the responsibility to make the world a better place. She wants us to do that. And she wants the machines to be our allies in some ways, to the extent possible. And it's a model of morality that is, it resonates a little bit with the title of the novel, Culpability, that this is a general age of responsibility that we're in. And it's up to us, as she says in some of the closing words of the book, it's going to be up to us whether they make us better.
In May, we spoke with journalist Brian Goldstone about his powerful book, There Is No Place for Us, Working and Homeless in America. It's an eye-opening, deeply reported portrait of families who work full-time, yet are unhoused, navigating a system that often punishes them for being poor. Goldstone told us that homelessness in the U.S. is no longer just a crisis of poverty, but actually a crisis of prosperity, unequally shared.
What I document in the book by cobbling together different data sources is that the true scale, the true severity of homelessness in the United States right now is, and this is a conservative estimate, about 6 times greater than that official number. The official count showed about 770,000 men, women, and children unhoused this past year. And I argue that the true number is closer to 4 million. So we're talking about a truly just cataclysmic phenomenon that is just severely undercounted and I would argue severely misunderstood.
We had a remarkable conversation with Reality Winner, the NSA whistleblower who leaked proof of Russian interference in the 2016 election and paid for it with the harshest sentence ever imposed under the Espionage Act. Her memoir, I Am Not Your Enemy, tells a story of what led her to leak the document, the fallout from her arrest, and what her arrest tells us about our military-industrial complex and our eroding democracy.
There is not even one standard definition of the conduct that even warrants an indictment under 793E to begin with. But furthermore, to say, like at least in my case in particular, the prosecution read this vague yet menacing statement about irreparable harm was done to sources and methods immediately following the release of that document. And then the judge was very concerned by this. And then we were all whisked away upstairs to the top secret courtroom, right? Because it was told to the media in the regular courtroom that the damages done could not be said publicly and they had to remain in a secured environment. So we went upstairs and I was like, oh boy, here it is. Like, this is going to be the final nail in my coffin. And we get up there. And again, the prosecutor repeated the same vague yet menacing statement because under the Espionage Act, the government does not actually have to prove that you compromised anything. Just the act of releasing the document was a felony worthy of 10 years. It is one of the only laws in the entire United States judicial history that intent, criminal intent, does not need to be proven. All they have to do is say you had the document and you sent the document.
In November, we aired an incredible double bill. First, internationally known internet activist Cory Doctorow revealed the hidden mechanics behind the digital decay of our online platforms, how they move from serving users and businesses to exploiting them, and what systemic reforms, from antitrust enforcement to tech worker unions, can reverse the trend. His book is Enshittification.
A couple of years ago, I coined this sweary little word, enshittification, and people like the minor license to be just a bit profane. And when I connected it to a pretty technical, complex critique and theory of how platforms are going bad, that seemed to be the magic trick, that it took it from being more than just a novelty and into a framing device for understanding what's going wrong with the digital world and with our world more broadly.
Then Bill McKibben shared his unexpectedly hopeful vision for the climate, telling us about how plummeting solar and wind power costs are reshaping economies worldwide and creating a moral turning point for civilization itself. His book is Here Comes the Sun. So tell us how that might reshape global power structures, especially between the global north and the global south.
Well, think for a minute about, just think about, you know, what the last 100 years of geopolitics would have looked like if during that period oil had been of trivial value. Think how many wars and coups and assassination attempts and terrorist plots and stuff we would have averted if everybody was just able to provide this necessary commodity from the sun and wind that soaked their own countries. I find it incredibly liberating to contemplate that kind of world.
Finally, on our 1,000th episode since starting Writer's Voice in 2004, we spoke with Julian Brave Noisket about his powerful memoir, We Survived the Night. It weaves indigenous oral traditions, personal narrative, and political history. Noisket explores the legacy of residential schools, intergenerational trauma, the meaning of home, indigenous political traditions, and the contemporary struggle for land, water, and cultural continuity among Native Americans.
That really means a lot to us, you know, that we create connection and meaning with each other in that kind of a way, which I think is something that the rest of the world is struggling with right now because of the technology, because of the hyper-focus on the individual and the nuclear family over the last 60 years. Because of, you know, our society's complicated relationship to notions of tradition and identity. You know, I think that in certain ways, Indigenous peoples have retained things that it turns out are really fundamental to our humanity that modern capitalist society has struggled to do.
We had so many rich conversations in 2025 that this is by no means a complete list, but merely a sampler. Be sure to visit writersvoice.net for links to these and more of our shows. We hope you'll join us in 2026 for more of Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests. You can find our social media links there, too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.